accession number 18698, Reel 3.
Reel 3. And then the king himself decided that the guards should be made into an armoured division. The guards were their own armoured division, which was a relief for us because we expected any time then to go to the Middle East. That's where we were scheduled for. We were already issued with all gear and everything, you know. But then the king decided to make us into an armoured division, which led to the invasion, of course. And we went on a course at Tidworth and more places like that, you know, to be taught how to behave like tank men. Now, we never was, in my opinion, good tank men because we were too big, you know. There was a lot of big fellas in a tank. We had no tanks to start with. We were to run about with an arm going like this, boom, 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 you know, imitating a tank. But then we got Covenanters, 2-pounders, you know. You could spit at a German tank and do more damage than a 2-pounder could. And yet them poor souls in the desert were fighting the German tanks with 2-pounders. And we had these Covenanters. Then we got Crusaders. And then some joker thought up these Churchill jobs, you see. But we did extensive manoeuvres in Britain. Extensive manoeuvres, you know. And then we got Shermans, you see. 75mm, we thought, oh, well, we've got somewhat light now. But we hadn't. No, the Sherman was inadequate. It was a good tank without a lot of messing about, you know, maintenance. It would go for miles and miles, but its armament was poor. Its armour was poor. It was no match whatsoever when we really got up against the real tanks. But that took a long time. And 1942... went on Salisbury Plain. Oh, there'd be about 5,000 or 6,000 people on a big hillside, including a certain general. And we had to watch Spitfires attacking tanks on the bottom, bottomless valley below us, you know. Always all lined up like that. And somebody says, hey, this bugger's coming straight at us. And we says, nah, he'll take off. He'll go over top on us. We says, what? We see these twinklings, like the 8 machine guns firing straight at us. This is in the fairy tale. I think they killed about 120 of us, maybe, you know. People were going down all over the spot. There was 120 dead, you see. And we did not realise it was a Polish pilot who'd done that, who'd been blackmailed into it, and he was after this general. And this general was the one that was earmarked for the invasion. I've just forgotten his name now, but it slipped my mind. It's a long while ago for an old fella to remember. But he's been blackmailed, and he turned off, and he headed back over the channel to France, you know. But however, he was shot down, and he went into the channel, somewhere like that. And if any want proof of this, ask the Minister of Defence about this attack. In 1942, on soldiers, especially the Guards Armoured Division, 1942.
How close did the bullets come to you?
Very near. And the badly wounded this general, I'm trying to remember his name. He was eventually become a field marshal. He got back. He was a boy, really, that the DMR to take charge of the British part of the invasion, but he didn't do it then, of course.
Did you lose any comrades?
Yes, several of them, yeah. Several of them.
From your company?
Oh, yes, aye. From my own platoon, from my signal platoon, yes. Well, I was a tank platoon, that tank troop then, yes. And that's facts, is that, not fiction. Facts. I'll show you before you go anywhere. And then, of course, we were preparing then. It was all rehearsing for D-Day, and we come up north, I remember we come by war flats, that's railways, you know, each carry 50 tanks, you know, Shermans. We'll come up here to Yorkshire Moors. And we pulled up one morning. It was still not quite light. We'd been travelling day and night, you know, slow but moving. I put my head out the window and says, "Where are we?" And a very familiar, friendly voice shouts out, "You're 4 miles this side of Driffield." I said, "Hey, we're in God's own county, Yorkshire." We didn't know where we were going, you know. We come up here to the Yorkshire Moors, to Emsley. And then Sledmere, and them places. And it was harvest time. Went through all the harvest fields, flattened them. Of course, the farmers were going well compensated. They said, "Come on in here, lads, come on in here." But one, you know, because they were going well compensated, flatten it. But one farmer, he said, "If I had some grenades, I'd throw them at you." And I said, "Well, I don't like doing this. We're doing it because we get told to. We want to go home." I said, "I'd like to be harvesting with you instead of messing about like this." You know. And then it came to the... We were sent on a waterproofing course to be taught how to waterproof tanks, you know, ready for the invasion. Every nut and every bolt had to be full of this stuff, and all was plugged in, and, you know, everything was sealed. Then when we hit the beach, you see, that all the driver did was plug in, and this gun cotton blew it all off. It just freed everything, guns, turret, you know, your hatches and everything else, and you was free, you know. And we moved down south, and it was good down there, really, you know, watching all what was all developing in massive. I couldn't believe it, you know, to see the huge masses of tanks, miles upon miles of tanks, Shermans mostly, you know, ammunition dumps, petrol dumps, huge, you couldn't describe it, you know. And we went to near Brighton, that's where we was. I remember going into Tommy Fire. You remember Tommy Fire, the boxer? He had a bar there, you know. We'd go in and... But then all of a sudden, all the civilians was taken out of Brighton, took out, you know. It was a no-go area. No-go area.
What was your job in the tank?
Well, I was a gunner operator. A wireless operator, gun loader, loader operator. That's what I was, to start with. And that was my job. I wanted my wife then had a little girl called Christine. She was only a few months old. She was born in February, and we were ready to go, you know. And I thought, I'm going to go see her. And I made a pass out to go to Salisbury. It was all a lie. It was a fiddle pass, you know. And I jumped on a train and went to London and got off at Wimbledon or something like that. I didn't go into King's Cross. I knew that. Waterloo were off into. I knew it would be going all with MPs and snowdrops, waiting to grab you. And I jumped off, and Doris was in London with my little girl then. And it's funny, you know, when it was going bombed, although I've been used to it, my legs used to start knocking like that. My knees would knock like that, because I was with my wife and child, you know. We'd always agreed if the house got hit, I'd suffocate. I'd pull a slip over, a pillar over, and suffocate her. That's what we planned. We would, thank the God, no need to do that. But on the way, I had to go back through Waterloo Station, and a red cap stopped me, a corporal. And I was a corporal then. He says, "Where are you going?" I says, "Salisbury." He said, "Look at your pass." He looked at me and says, "Oh, yes, you're all right." And I walked away from him. Doris was with me. And this MP sergeant, she would go, "Hey, he checked his pass." "No." He said, "Yes, I have." "Where's he going?" He says, "Salisbury." He says, "Look, you fool. See that Guards Armoured Division, they ever recognised Guards Armoured Division, their invasion troops, they're out of bounds, he's out of bounds, you see." And he took all my details. I thought, "Oh, I'm going to get into trouble here." Going back to Brighton, Gosport, really. And I gets back there, and there was two sergeants waiting for me. I thought, "Oh, I'm going to get novelty here." There was both regiment of police sergeants. Says, "Congratulations, you joined the mess tomorrow, you've been promoted. You're going to get made into a sergeant." So I did, I got made into a sergeant. You know. And then we gets to Gosport, and we've got under Yankee landing craft. Yankee crew. Good food. But the first thing they did was steal all our sidearms. We had 38 Colts, which we used to strap to our legs, you know. We used to hang them up in the tanks, down in the ship's hold, hang them. And they stole them. And the Yankee captain gone, "These are only little things out there," said. "Now look here," he said, "you guys, these lammies have had their guns pinched." He said, "They want to be put back, otherwise there'll be no shore leave for a month," you know, like that. And they were all put back. But Montgomery kept on asking for infantry, was infantry one did, not tanks then, you know, the initial landings. Infantry, we was itching, we were at sea and bloody seasick and God knows what. And these Yanks hadn't fastened the Sherman's down, and there were 32 ton, you know, and they broke loose. There was a storm, and, you know, and it was brrr, bang, bang. Of course, they were welded, was them, the Yankee ships, you see, and we were frightened of them pushing through the sides, so was the captain. And he made the crew go down there and fasten them tanks up, sliding about in a rough sea. And they fastened them, did them Yanks, they fastened them. Wasn't that marvellous, eh? Then, when we arrived, they dropped these ramps, and there was a Yankee in front, a sailor, measuring with a plumb bob thing, the deepness, you know, how deep the water was. They had a proper name for it, I called it a plumb bob, it had a lead weight on the string, and then waving us down. And our first tank went straight down, and it went into 20 foot of water. You know, they had the breathers on, but they can only take so much, and because he just went out of sight and bubbles come up, and that was the end of him. A crew gone without him, you know, and that was upsetting. And then we had to back off and go in again, you see. And ours was next tank off, and I was a tank commander then taking it off. And this Yank waved on us down, and halfway down he tried to stop us. And George, my driver, George Denham, pulled on his left-hand tiller, and it skidded. It went sideways, and hit the water sideways, and went like this. I thought, oh, we'll have to go over. And we're fastened in. We couldn't get out, you know. We're fastened down. You couldn't put your heads out. You're fastened down, all sealed in. I thought, we're going to go over. But then it righted itself like that. And the tracks hit the sand. And we got on the beach. And then Denham, George Denham, plugged in. And boof, this gun freed everything then. And in we went.
Was this D-Day itself?
No, after D-Day, 7 or 8 days after D-Day. We were at sea for a while, because there was calling for more and more infantry, more infantry. It was the infantry that was taking the armour. It was then that they'd come up again, the formidable, most formidable army in the world. As if it weren't been for Russia, we would never have ever got a breed of getting on there. We would have never have got on. They'd have seen to that. Now, it was Hitler interfering all the time with his generals that lost them the war. And the Russians, of course. Right. Well, then it turned into a bloody nightmare then. Everything was a nightmare. Normandy, being a country lad like me, Normandy was lovely, you know, but it smelt of death everywhere. Everything was dead cows, dead people, smashed up villages. They resented us going, you know, did the French. You couldn't blame them, really. And all the people that was liberated without any bombing and destroying their homes, their threat is different to what the Normans did. The Normans would try to come with their farming, ignoring us, no matter what the hell was going on, you know, bloody definitely stubborn people, you know, all right, like. And there was a donkey next to where we was, in our lager area, and this farmer was always trying to tell us how chuffed he was with it, because he'd only got one testicle. And he said, it's still good, he was shouting out. God knows what it was good at, but you used to shout out. But then, on the 18th of July, it was Operation Goodwood. This was a big, nearly all our battles was named after race meetings. It was Goodwood, Epsom, you name it. It was all those other, you know, race meetings. But this was Operation Goodwood, where Montgomery would throw in the 11th Armoured, the 7th Armoured and the Guards Armoured. Three armoured divisions would, for the first time, lead the way without infantry. But going in front, there was 2,400 bombers, heavy bombers, light bombers, typhoons, rocket firing typhoons, would go in front of us. But what we didn't know, there was eight gun lines waiting for us of 88 millimetres, and Tiger tanks dug in, and Panther tanks dug in, eight gun lines, eight defence lines. And the bombing had had hardly any effect on them. It certainly wiped out a few tanks, but not many. And they were waiting for us. And that Guards Armoured Division lost 60 tanks in about half an hour, you know.
What do you remember of it personally?
Going along like the bloody clappers, you know, and turrets, you know, in front of us blowing up, and zigzag. The turret weighed 5 ton, you know, it was 88 millimetres, 150 millimetres, just blowing to pieces, and all black smoke and God knows what, and just seemed like we'd never been in action before, you know. Hell on earth, somebody gone mad. And Sir William Ansell de Grey was our commander. He said, this is madness. He says, fire smoke, stop them, you know. He ordered all tanks to fire smoke to hide us, you know. Otherwise, they'd have bloody... The Jerry's was waiting for us, 88mm guns. It was the 10th SS, and it was the 12th SS, and it was this, that, and t'other. And they was real soldiers, you know what I mean? They could rely on that 88mm and them Panther tanks and them Tigers, and you'll want it from a Sherman. They call them British Tommy Cookers. We call them Ronsons, you know, cigarette lighters, Sherman. Carried 150 gallon of petrol. I'm not talking about diesel, petrol. Tin armour, hit with a foo, you know. Then the frizzle, you know. But then that really shook us to the core. That 18th of July shook the armoured division to the core. There was a Jerry called Captain Whitman, what we'd heard about. He was the ace man. And he attacked the 7th Armoured with himself. They were stopped on a roadside, you know. And he saw them and he said to his gunner, he said, I think the British think they've won the war already. He said, we're going to show them that they haven't. And I think he knocked out about 15 or 20 tanks on his own. Mostly Shermans and Cromwells, you know. He had a Tiger, which was unstoppable. You couldn't, I mean, we were told to fire, well, 75 millimetres, firing a shell about that big, solid shot, at the driver's hatch. And there was a possibility that he'd stun the driver. I mean, that made you frightened, didn't it? Everybody's rectum went in and out and out and out, you know, frightened. There was. And that, you know, that destroyed a lot of our morale and everything else did that. That is something here that we can't take on. If you had a fair fight, you know, I mean, some of the best regiments in England, in Normandy, was getting torn to pieces and they were losing that essence of get up and go. They didn't want to get up and go, you know. They knew bloody well what was waiting for them. But gradually, of course...
When you made that smoke,
yeah,
the orders of the officer...
Yes, that added.
What
happened that then? We retreated. Right. That smoke, this, you know, they were firing haphazardly at us then. They weren't picking us off with a pish, you know, which they were pip, like that. I mean, they were having the time of their lives knocking us off with them 88mm and the Tigers. I mean, they could outgun us by a mile and a half. Outgun us by range, you know, easy.
Did your tank have a name?
Yes, Codrington. Yeah.
And which troop and squadron were you?
That was an headquarter squadron. I was with Sir William and Sutter Gray, and my commander was Colonel Middleton, who got kicked back to England for that effort, for throwing smoke, you know, and withdrawing. Montgomery got rid of him. He shouldn't have done, because he was a bloody good commander. He was a good colonel. He said, we spent 3 years training in England. 3 years. We destroyed in 20 minutes, you know. Because he knew what it was doing to the morale of the men. You see, we had some good officers, but without the men, they're useless. The men count, you know. When the conscripts started to come up to us, RCO says there are conscripts, go easy on them. They've got to do it, and we can't win the war without them. They aren't regulars. We had to do it because we're regulars, but he said they haven't. They've been brought into it. The civilians, you see. Hey, and...
But you're with the First Coast Guards? So.
Yes, yeah.
And then after Goodwood?
Well, then after Goodwood, we were licking our wounds quite a while. Licking our wounds, and Montgomery was sacking diff commanders one after another. And the Yanks was having a struggle. They'd already took Cherbourg, you know. And then Patton arrived on the scene. Blood and Guts Patton arrived on the scene. And we had another go. Cairn should have fell the first day, you know, but it didn't fall for 6 weeks, more than that. And when we did get it, we stood on our tank tops and watched 900 Lancasters flatten Cairn. There were no Jerry soldiers in it. Civilians they were killing. That was a sad thing, you know. It was terrible as Cairn. But eventually, you see, the Germans couldn't... We wouldn't have got anywhere near it if it hadn't been for the RAF and the Yankees, you know, the Yanksters, bombers. I know they used to bomb us a lot, but nevertheless... They whittled the German Air Force down. There was hardly any bother from the Luftwaffe at all, you know. But the German soldier was standing his ground. It was a battle of attrition. And gradually, we had more troops than them, more guns, more shells, more tanks and everything. Not as good as theirs, but we had more of them, you know. Reinforcements and a battle of attrition. And gradually, Once the SS was broke, and the SS was broke, you know, on the anvil, then they started to retreat. And I don't mean run away, they were retreating. It made us pay all the way along, bump into them, but the pattern come rolling round, and then there was Fallis, you see. And you could smell Fallis war 20 mile away. Dead Jerrys and dead Osses, dead people. We didn't take any part in the Battle of Fallis. The Canadians did do, and the Yanks, but mostly Canadians, and the British, but all we had to do, we were cleaning up the battlefield. It was just for cleaning up the battlefield, you know, big lines of us, bringing in all sorts of things, which it was all right for souvenirs and things, but it weren't fighting.
What? How did you do the cleaning?
Well, we had the lorries and put things on lorries, but we had to be careful, of course. There was lots of booby traps, you know. One of their booby traps was, they used to zip fastener bags they had, you know, as though they're holding your shaving gear, you know. As though they looked as though they had razors in, and some of the silly ones used to pick on, but after being told, they'd find them laid in edges and on paths, you know. And they'd pull the zip like this, riff, and then the bodies would be riddled with ball bearings, you know. Another trick of the Jerrys was, if we went in a house, and this is how they caught the recruits out, I knew better that after a while, you'd go in and there'd be a full toilet, look you, full of excreta, and they'd say, they're mucky buggers, and pull that chain, ruff! The house used to just blow to bits, and any bugger in it got it as well, you know. But then you learnt them tricks. But then we crossed the border into Belgium, see. And we had to take this village called Eppen. And it was a tough trip. I've since become very friendly with a German captain. He was that proud. I met him after the war and I correspond with him now. He brought 17 Panthers with him from Russia to get in front of the Guards Armour Division. He was that pleased that he held up our 523 Shermans for a day. He was that proud of that fact.
That's Eppen.
Pardon?
At Eppen.
At Eppen, yes. Eppen, yeah. Yeah, Eppen or Eppen, yes, you see. Now then, there happened something there at Eppen that not many folks know about. The Marquess of Hartington was killed there, heir to the Duke of Devonshire's seat, Chatsworth House, right? And he was married to Kathleen Kennedy's. To John F. Kennedy's sister, Kathleen Kennedy. He was married to her. And Anstruther the Grey shouted out, that's Billy Cavendish laid there. And that was the Marquess of Hartington. And there was a woman cuddling him, you know. And he was bleeding. He'd been shot. Anstruther the Grey told me. Now, Sir William Anstruther the Grey was chairman of the 1922 Backbench Committee and deputy speaker of the House of Commons. Tory MP, along with a lot of power and a tough and a bloody good soldier. Good soldier. Really good, brave soldier. Tough one. He hated the Germans. He hated them. With hatred, like, what I would never amount to. I couldn't ever hate anybody like that. But he was a good soldier, and he says, that's Billy Cavendish. And that was the Marquess of Arton, and heir to Chatsworth House, you know. You know Chatsworth here, don't you? And
did you see it, Hartington?
You saw him. I saw a fellow laid there with a corduroy trousers on and a fancy coat on and a scarf. You know, the judge officers used to dress like that. Do you know why they did? Do you know why they dressed like that? No. So you could identify them in battle. You knew they were there with you. I'll say this for the guards officers. They were all toffs, most of them snobs, you know, from the big families, but they were brave. Montgomery said after a while there was that many young officers going killed that the sergeants would lead the way. The guards officers stood up as one man and says, never. We refuse that order. Guards officers lead, they never follow. Which is true. After me, they'd say. Not after you. Oh, no, you can't deny that. Anyway, when we come back to Mouvoir dead and wounded, we never did take up for a couple of days. The Jerrys was holding it firmly. And we taking all wounded back and dead. And this bloke was already buried, was Marquess of Hartington, you know. She'd buried him, this woman, and her husband, in the garden. They afterwards picked him up and put him, you know, years, a long while after the war, they picked him up and put him, you know. And then we get to Eppen, and we'd had a bad time, and then Montgomery said to Oryx, he was our corps commander, General Oryx, you'll have maybe heard of him, Go take Brussels, Guards Armoured Division had to take Brussels, which was 92 mile in front. We gets into Brussels, the Welsh Guards was leading, they gets into Brussels that night, that same night, you know, in a day. And nobody was there to greet them. The Sibbys was all hiding. They didn't realise. They were Allied tanks. And when they did realise, they went mad. What do we had? Oh, there was bloody thousands and thousands of people. We had a right good do, you know. Really good do in Brussels. What a welcome they gave us. That was on the 3rd of September 1944. You see? 5 years after they actually declared war. And, of course, a lot of souvenirs flying about in there. Jerry's. We gets to Brussels and there was this great big dump, food dump and wine dump, and there was maybe 50,000 bottles of champagne in it alone, you know. And the civvies wanted some of this, and answer, they says, no, reserve a pour le militaire, reserve for the military, they wouldn't let them in. It was booby trapped, you know. But we soon sorted that out. And we loaded up with this booze. We're still supping it about 4 months afterwards, you know. Every tank was loading up, because we were moving up. We were up back to the place where we first met them, Louvain. Ironical, isn't it? And then we looked for the grave of Lord Frederick Cambridge there, because that's where he got killed in 1940. And he was cousin to the king, was Lord Frederick Cambridge. Full cousin to the king. I liked him very much. He used to come into my little spot, and we used to pin up gals on, you know. And he went on leave, and the next lieutenant says, take all them down, filthy things, we're not going to hear them, you know. And when Lord Frederick Cambridge came back off the leave, he tells us to put him back up again. You know, he was a laugh. He was all right. He was only 22 when he got killed. A cousin of the king. Well, anyway, from Brussels and Louvain, and then Montgomery thought up that foolhardy scheme about Arnhem, a bridge too far. Anstruther Grey went, and he come back. He said, the little man's flipped his bonnet. He's gone off his rocker, he said. Well, he said, five bridges, he said, pointing it on the map to this place called Arnhem. One road, pulled the land on each side, flooded. He said, there's ain't room for two bloody tanks to pass each other. He said, that madman has just told us that the Germans are beaten. And he said, I couldn't believe it. I nearly fell out my chair. We in Montgomery said the Germans are beaten. The Germans are far, far from getting beaten. He's going to launch two... American airborne and one British, you see, and he said, fool, you know, we cannot do it, he said, no matter how tired we didn't do it, you know, and we could hear the Paris, they've never forgiven us for it, and the Paris saying, where are you, what are you waiting for, and what's holding you up, what it was, one tank at a time, you know, and the Jerry's was covering that with 88s, they kept breaking behind us and cutting us off, and we get stopping and clearing that road up and clearing that road up. We get to Arnhem, and the Grenadiers took Nijmegen. We get to Nijmegen, not Arnhem, we get to Nijmegen, which is a bloody great bridge. We'd already take Grave Bridge, and it was a massive bridge. Then we get to Nijmegen, and the Grenadier Guards took Nijmegen, and Lord Carrington was one of them on that bridge, that, you know, MP. He used to be welling with Maggie Thatcher then, and then there was that other fella, oh, I'm forgetting his name, but MP, I shouldn't forget him, Whitelaw, he was on there. And we bricked, and in Nijmegen we could have wept, because there was very dead guys when they had all over, it was a bad do. And the Jerry's was coming up the sewers at night time, you know, and attacking us from behind, and there was frogmen attacking the bridge, and we get through, and we got about 3 miles that side to a place called Els, on the way to Arnhem, and that's where they stopped us dead. That's where the... So it was still a single line, you know. It's first time I saw... I saw my first dead German there with ginger hair. I never seen a ginger hair. I said, look at that red-headed Jerry laid there. And his helmet was hanging up down, and he was on an anti-aircraft gun.